It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It was characterized as an opportunity for Governor Wolf to make a declaration of his principles. His first budget address outlined an ambitious agenda for the upcoming fiscal year, including raising the state's sales tax rate and the personal income tax rate to help pay for a substantial increase in school funding. Here to discuss what the governor is proposing is State Senator Jim Brewster, a Democrat. Senator Brewster, joining us by phone. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be there, Paul.
We have attempted to reach a number of GOP senators, including Volokovich, Vogel, and Wagner, as well as Republican representatives Mustio and Reed. None was available to join us today. We'd like to sample your reaction to the governor's budget address. You can call 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. We would be happy to hear from the Republicans in our audience and gather your thoughts about the governor's address. Senator Brewster, Governor Wolf proposing more than $4 billion in higher taxes on income, sales, and natural gas drilling to support new spending on schools and to cut property taxes as part of an effort to overhaul the way public education is funding. Some Republicans have characterized this as yet another tax and spend proposal from a Democrat. So let's start with this. What do you think of what the governor is doing here?
Well, I think we started off the conversation with the wrong introduction. It's a 50% reduction in homeowner property taxes. I can tell you that myself and my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, on the Republican side, for quite some time have been supporting Senate Bill 76, which is the elimination of school property tax. So I'm a little confused at why we didn't start off with that introduction. But nonetheless, I think it's a good start. Let's be clear that there's an awful lot to negotiate in here. Senate Bill 76, I want to bring that up because that had bipartisan support. And frankly, it was a Republican bill, and they could not get it passed the past couple of years. I actually tried to get Democrats on my side of the aisle to support it. And in that bill, it specifically eliminates school property tax and replaces it with what a lot of people think are a fairer tax, that being an increased sales tax and some slight increase in the PIT. But I will tell you, with regard to 76 and the governor's proposal, I'm not a huge fan of the wage tax increase. I would much rather see it go more towards the sales tax because it's a fair tax. People that visit the state and everyone that comes to our state would participate in picking up some of that burden. I'm opposed to any more taxes on the property owners. I mean, it's time that we're losing population for a reason, and I think that's a big reason. So I think that's the headline of the story.
And, of course, the governor is calling for increasing the state's share of funding for public education to 50%. So as far as the increases combined with the cuts that he's calling for, the property tax cut, as well as a shale gas tax, and we'll get into some of that here in a moment. But as far as this 50% increase in funding public education, is this the way to go as far as you're concerned?
Well, let's just look at the facts, Paul. The last 2 years, and I don't want to look back. One of the things I've learned in this business is you don't want to look over your shoulder too much. We've got to move forward. But I don't think we can ignore the fact that this governor has inherited a $2.4 billion deficit. Now, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, who I have great respect for, there are some good minds on both sides of the aisle, no question. But the fact of the matter is, the last 4 years, Harrisburg has been controlled by the majority party. So that $2.45 billion, whatever it might end up being, is an inherited deficit that the Democrats had no control over. So we have to stop blaming each other and just attend to the facts. Now, you ask about education. 2 years ago, education was cut $1 billion by the governor. Now, one can debate that there should have been some cuts. We could have talked about that, negotiated it. I don't think it needed to be $1 billion, but the fact of the matter is, once that happened, 400 school districts out of 500 raised their local school property tax. So that was a de facto tax increase. That's just a fact. And everybody knew that was going to happen. But I would say the other 100 school districts that did not raise their taxes, if you check, you'll see that their fund balances are significantly lower. So local school boards did exactly what they had to do to pay the bills. We didn't fix anything. All we did was push it down the road, and 25,000 people lost their jobs.
So, you know, as you look at this overall proposal, you know, there are a lot of moving pieces in it, and it's going to be debated, and you know, all sorts of revisions are going to be brought up and proposed between now and June 30th. What are the concerns that you have about the ability, with all of the things that all of the intricate aspects of this budget proposal, that it will in fact eliminate the deficit?
Well, obviously, as you said, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of unknowns at this point. I think the transition from partial property tax relief to different sources of revenue, i.e. the PIT and sales tax, one of the things we've been wrestling with the past couple of years is for those of us on both sides of the aisle that really feel that the property owners have really carried the ball too much and need some relief. The problem is the transition from a stable tax, a more predictable tax, that being property tax, to a more unpredictable tax, being sales and wage tax, because the economy will affect those two line items. And whereas on the property tax side, it's more predictable, the delinquencies are more predictable. That's no reason not to make some movement. That's why I'm supporting what the governor has proposed, because this is a great day for Pennsylvania. This is a chance to eliminate an onerous tax that's really hit the same group of people for way too many years. But that transition won't be easy, and it's not as predictable as a lot of people think. So I'm a little worried about how we monitor that progress. With regard to job creation, as we know, in the past 4 years, we've gone from 8th in the country in job creation to the last, 50th. Now, again, I'm not trying to look back, but we can't ignore the fact that this state's losing jobs, and we have to deal with why that's happening. And frankly, it's a little hard to imagine that with the Marcellus Shale play, which we know has brought jobs to our state. So where would we be without that industry? And we can talk about that later.
Yeah, I do want to get into the tax, but you know, another thing I wanted to bring up was one of the more innovative proposals that the governor mentioned yesterday is an effort to create what he calls new good-paying jobs by establishing a Made in Pennsylvania job creation program. Can an approach like this pay off, in your opinion?
Well, I hope so. I don't know about the rest of your listening audience, but you know, I'm getting a little tired of picking up products that are made in other countries. It used to be that meant something to people, and I think we need to pay attention. I think charity begins at home. I think we should buy Pennsylvania when we can. Sometimes in the business world, it's not always practical, but right now it's been unbridled. There hasn't been anyone overseeing that. I can go back to when I was young, very young child, and if my grandfather picked up something made in Japan, he didn't put it down, he threw it down. Now, I'm not suggesting that we haven't come a long way with that, but we have to start paying attention. We have to buy local, whether it's a local city or a township or a borough, county, in this particular case, a state. We should try and spend our money with Pennsylvania companies, and we should embrace the idea that they need to flourish. And I think most people realize that small businesses really is the economic generator. They create products, they create jobs, which expands our revenue, our ability to get revenue. And what that does, it prevents us from having to go out and initiate new taxes. That's what we're trying to avoid. Give small businesses a chance to grow. And by the way, Paul, just to point out, also in the governor's proposal, and I think this is supported by the other side of the aisle, you've got almost a 50% cut in CNI, and you've got a complete elimination of the corporate tax and franchise, corporate stock and franchise tax. And both of those are business-friendly, and I believe will help small businesses grow, hire more people, and I think that will have an effect on the public that we won't see quite as clearly out of the gate, but over time, I think individual homeowners will see the benefit of that.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest, State Senator Jim Brewster, joining us as we talk about the governor's budget address yesterday. The number to join the conversation, 412-246-2002. And we have Ted in Mount Washington who's been waiting. Ted, welcome. You're on the air with Senator Brewster.
How you doing, Senator?
Hi, Ted. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Real quick, the question I have is pension reform. It seems to me both parties are kicking the can down the road. When will we get pension reform? And also, I guess the governor is talking about putting investments in bonds. To me, it really doesn't solve the problem. Where are you going to get the revenue to either save the pension program or do something a little bit different like 401ks?
Well, Ted, that's a very good question. And frankly, it's probably our biggest problem. One, because there are so many people involved with these pensions. I mean, these are, let's face it, these are contracts that people had, a handshake contract. Look, if I do this job, I'll have a pension when I'm done. And we have to make sure that we don't, nobody would want their pension to go away at age 50 or 55 just because we couldn't find a way to get it done correctly. Now, it could be that some of these pensions were ill-advised in the beginning. The fact of the matter is we've inherited what we've inherited. And I think the bond issue that the governor mentioned, you're right, it doesn't fix it, but it mitigates some of the problem. The 401k discussion is something that is on the table. I would say to you, Ted, that the sooner we get a bipartisan approach, get to the table and really sit down and try and find a way to fix the problem as opposed to trying to find victims. We do that all too often in politics. And there's always a handful of political leaders that think there should be winners and losers. I'm not one of those. I think there's a middle road on every issue. But to your point, the 401k issue is an option, but it doesn't fix our pension debt because the 401k folks, the new employees per se, would not be paying into that pot of money. So it doesn't improve the financial condition of that particular pot of money for the existing pensions. It does help going forward. Act 120, which was put in place before I went to Harrisburg, a lot of legislators will tell you that has a smoothing effect. It'll take a longer time to heal the problem, but it's also in place. So you've got Act 20. You've got the bond suggestion by the governor. You have the 401k discussion. And frankly, the fourth part of the equation is, when are we all going to sit down and try to come up with an answer that answers Ted's question without making it political? And that's the part, you know, as a 27-year banker, I have to tell you, some of the behavior I've seen really on both sides of the aisle, if you're in the private sector, you get fired the next day. We have to stop this idea of making this an independent Republican-Democrat issue. This is the people issue. And so I didn't give you any clear answer, Ted, but I gave you the options that are out there and the direction I think we're going. But we've got some good minds in Harrisburg, despite what some people may think. And I think if we get them at the table, we're going to find the answer that will give us a permanent fix.
The governor is proposing a 5% severance tax on natural gas producers. He says this will generate more than $1 billion in annual revenues. We have Joe in Monroeville who wants to comment on this. Joe? Welcome to the conversation with Senator Brewster.
Hi, Joe.
Hello, Joe. Joe in Monroeville, are you there? Going once, going twice. Well, he wanted to comment. He said at some point they will stop drilling, and when it stops, what is their plan? And he's speaking to the concerns that both Democrats and Republicans have. Senator, who say that this proposal by the governor, the 5% severance tax, will hurt the shale gas industry. What are your thoughts?
I wish Joe would have been on the line because he's a constituent, and I certainly appreciate his thoughts on the issue. But let me say this. Out of the gate, I'm probably the biggest fan of the Marcellus shale industry that I know. And I don't want to get into a lot of detail there, but I could base that on fact. But just, you have to take my word on that. Now, having said that, I voted against the impact fee 4 years ago. It has a net effect rate of about 1.8%. The rest of the country is averaging somewhere between 6 or 7%. Now, to this issue that they're going to go somewhere, now this is the industry talking. We sit on arguably the largest deposit of natural gas in the world. They're not going to go anywhere. So we need to dismiss that thought. Yes, will production fluctuate up and down? No question. That will be driven by the market, just like any other business. Okay, so let's get past this myth and this misleading comments that you get from the industry. They're not going anywhere. This play, the Marcellus Shale, you've got the Devonian, you've got Utica, is underneath 1,800 communities in the state of Pennsylvania out of 2,500. A little bit of New York, a little bit of Ohio, a little bit of West Virginia. It's such a good play and such a great resource. I read the other day where the lower tier of New York would like to secede from New York and become part of Pennsylvania so that they could take advantage of that resource. So whoever's telling someone that they're going to leave, I don't see that happening. You know, we've been dependent on the Middle East on oil. Pennsylvania could be the Middle East with regard to natural gas. That's my mindset. Now,
Do we need to explore renewable energy, though? That's another thing the governor called for.
I think that's in the governor's discussion. But I just want to finish up on Marcellus because I don't want to leave any doubt. You know, this is a great opportunity. It's a great industry, some great companies involved. And they did what they were supposed to do for their shareholders 4 years ago. They negotiated a good deal. That's what the private sector is supposed to do. We didn't live up to our challenge on our end on behalf of the taxpayers. Okay. Now, again, this is a negotiable item. And as I've talked to some of the people in the industry, let's just not sit down and say, well, it's going to be 5% or 6%. I have a bill that I just introduced, a second bill, where the revenue would go towards education. Now, think about that. If it goes towards education, that eliminates and mitigates any opportunity for local school districts to raise their school taxes. So indirectly, that's an advantage to the taxpayers. But, you know, it's a negotiable number. It's not something that we should just slam the door on. And I've had some conversations about
this. I'm sorry to jump in, Senator, because we're just about out of time. But you're saying that the 5% severance tax, the 5% number is negotiable, that you maybe would like to see it go in maybe up or down?
It could go down. Keep in mind, the 1.8% stays. So any community and any individual that's benefiting from the current impact fee will still get that money. So it's about a 4%, 5% on top of that. I think we can negotiate that. I'm not going to speak for the governor. I'm just saying my personal vote, I have no problem with negotiating that number down.
If it stays at 5%, would you vote in favor of it?
We'd have to talk about that.
Senator Jim Brewster joining us. Senator, we know you're in transit. We thank you for your time. It was a pleasure talking with you here today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. Be happy to come back anytime.
Sounds good. Coming up, now that net neutrality rules have been adopted by U.S. regulators, what's next? We'll talk with U.S. Congressman Mike Doyle and straight ahead, making the case for renewing the charter of the Export-Import Bank. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A number of small business leaders from across the nation converged on Washington last week. They were meeting with congressmen and senators as part of the XM Coalition in hopes of convincing them to renew the charter of the Export-Import Bank, which expires in June. One of the people taking part is Jesse Rothschild, Business Development Manager at Penn United Technologies in Butler County. Jesse Rothschild, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thank you for having me.
For our listeners who are not familiar with it, what is the Export-Import Bank?
The Export-Import Bank provides either direct financing or loan guarantees through smaller banks or local banks for people doing export business or for the financing customers overseas to buy U.S. products and goods.
If the charter expires in June, what will this mean for U.S. companies?
United States has a great number of businesses supported directly and indirectly by the Export-Import Bank. It basically puts us on an even footing when we're competing with international companies who have oftentimes direct government financing and support. For Penn United in Butler County, the Export-Import Bank is not a direct source of funding for us, but many of our customers are supported directly or indirectly by EXIM financing. And we're able to attribute a minimum of 20 jobs at Penn United directly to that financing structure that supports our clients.
You were in Washington, D.C. last week to speak with leaders of Congress about the Export-Import Bank. What progress has been made?
Well, I'm happy to say that of the 5 representatives and 2 senators from Louisiana that I spoke with on behalf of Penn United customers, I'm pretty confident that at least 4 of those representatives are on board, and at least 1 of the senators is on board, possibly both senators. This is really good for us, but of course there are some struggles. Part of the struggles were articulated by Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey about the issue of how does EXIM Bank financing support free enterprise kind of flies in the face of it to some people's perspectives. And so that's a challenge we're trying to overcome.
So you're saying that the senators don't understand how this funding supports export-import business?
Well, I think they fully understand how it supports export-import business. The problem, of course, is a challenge of when we're talking about smaller government and supporting free enterprise, how can we then, out of the other side of our mouth, talk about supplying preferential financing terms for export business? The reality is that within the United States, it's easy to talk about the ideals of free enterprise, but the minute we step outside of our borders, we're not fighting a fair fight anymore because the people we compete against throughout Europe and Asia and other countries have governmental support. There's up to 58 government financing agencies outside of the United States that support our competitors. So if free enterprise is our goal, that's great. But before we can let the EXIM Bank die off in support of that principle, we have to first export free enterprise itself through trade reforms that can be enforced through WTO, et cetera. Until then, the United States can't be the only guy bringing a knife to a gunfight in the international market.
So did Senator Toomey and some of the other legislators that you spoke to, did they understand where you were going with this? Did you feel that you made some headway? And did you get from them the idea that they would make a commitment to helping do the kinds of things that you feel are necessary?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to speak to Pat Toomey personally. But on the Louisiana side, with whom I did speak, I'm happy to say that I think people do understand. I do know that there's some political challenges facing people dealing with free enterprise perspectives domestically, and how do they reconcile that with export support. But overwhelmingly, I think people get the principle that even if 75% of EXIM financing goes to major corporations such as GE and Boeing, all that money trickles down to all the entire supply network that supports those people. Boeing is an incidental client of ours. That is, our customers support Boeing. We have direct business with GE. And many other customers who receive that EXIM financing are our customers or our customers' customers. And people get that. People get that there is an entire network of supply chain all the way from raw materials to machining and manufacturing all the way down to the truck drivers that deliver those things. But they do have a trouble in some cases, such as with Senator Toomey, in reconciling free enterprise principles with that support outside of the country.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Jesse Rothschild, Business Development Manager at Penn United Technologies in Butler County. In addition to renewing the charter, what else would you like to see happen regarding the Export-Import Bank?
Well, the most important thing, I think, is that we don't do a short-term renewal. Oftentimes, these short-term renewals are used as negotiating tactics or a way of stalling and dealing with more sensitive issues at a later date. The problem is that a lot of projects that are substantially supported by export-import funding are long-term projects. For example, an installation of, a offshore well platform in the Gulf of Mexico or in the North Sea or in Southeast Asia from drawing boards to installation could be 5 to 6.5 years. There had been some talk about some temporary renewals of the EXIM financing bank, but that's not going to do it. What we really need is a 5 to 7 year extension.
So if the charter is renewed long-term, as you're saying it should be, what kind of job creation would it lead to in this region?
Well, Butler County, among the Butler County employees, Penn United is number 11th in employment. We're a Tier 1 manufacturer and Tier 2 manufacturer, which means we don't make the final products that go overseas. We sell to those people who do make those overseas shipment products. Approximately 60% of our oil and gas manufacturing parts that we do in Butler County end up assembled into equipment that is ultimately shipped overseas. That's a substantial part of that business. If EXIM financing is not renewed, then those sales from our customers overseas will be severely hampered, which means it will have a direct impact on the amount of business they do with Penn United and Butler.
Are the other Pennsylvania state representatives in favor of renewing the Export-Import Bank charter?
Well, I don't know the perspectives of each of the Pennsylvania reps and senators. I do know that the Democratic senator in Pennsylvania is in favor.
Bob Casey?
Yes, and I think, generally speaking, Pennsylvania representatives are indeed in favor. There is some challenges being put forth by Senator Toomey, and hopefully we can overcome those. I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and currently part-time reside in St. Francisville, Louisiana. Because of a substantial part of my work is oil and gas, I spend a huge amount of my time down in the Gulf South region, including in Texas, mostly Houston, of course. There's a big manufacturing structure in Pennsylvania that doesn't necessarily exist down south. And because of that, there's a lot of people able to participate from Pennsylvania. But the reality is that Penn United has customers all over the country and all over the world. And we don't receive direct export-import funding, which means that on behalf of our customers who do employ our people, I'm down there talking to the guys who care about the oil and gas sector. And with 30% of our oil and gas or of our business being directly associated with oil and gas, that's critical to the employment in Butler.
Jesse Rothschild is Business Development Manager at Penn United Technologies in Butler County. Mr. Rothschild, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The notion of regulating the internet using public utility laws has been under consideration for the past year. Now that net neutrality rules have been adopted by U.S. regulators, how will this long-running battle play out in Congress and the courts? I'm joined now by phone from Washington by Pittsburgh area U.S. Congressman Mike Doyle. Congressman Doyle, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Good, sir. Thank you. If you have a question or comment on net neutrality and exactly what these new rules mean going forward, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. Congressman Doyle, this whole push intensified back in November when the president made a public plea to the FCC commissioners to tie broadband internet to existing telecommunications laws. So what does it mean now that the FCC has approved this? You are one of those who is praising the FCC open internet plan. Explain what it means and why you're behind it.
Yeah, and in fact, Paul, what I'd like to do maybe first is just to say what net neutrality is, because there seems to be a lot of confusion amongst people. What is net neutrality? And so, you know, what I try to do is to bring this down in more layman's language. And so basically, you know, you have consumers at home and at work are connected to the internet on one side. And then you have online companies like Google, Facebook, Netflix, they're out on the internet on the other side. And then net neutrality is really about the middleman. In between those two groups, you have internet service providers like Comcast or Verizon or Cox that connect consumers to websites, apps, and services online. They act as the middleman. we believe consumers should have the right to access the content of their choice on the Internet, and that when people talk about content, you know, they're talking about websites like YouTube and Twitter or an app like Duolingo that I have on my computer. It's a great Pittsburgh company that teaches you new languages, or services like Netflix or Amazon Instant Video. So the other side of that is that these content providers should be able to access these consumers without having to pay a toll or have their service blocked or degraded by an ISP just because that's the only way they can get to the consumer. We saw this happen just last year between Netflix and Comcast over this very issue. So what the FCC has said in its order is that Internet service providers, the Comcast, the Verizons, the Cox, they can't use their position as that middleman between the consumer and the Internet to advantage themselves or their own products and services or third parties who want to get preferential treatment by paying them some sort of a fee. And that last point's really important because big content companies, they have an incentive to make it more expensive for competitors to compete by making things like fast lanes a necessity. But, you know, it also makes it more expensive for startups to roll out new products. So when you think about this rule, it's really not intended to protect the Googles and the Facebooks of the world. It's really intended to protect the next big thing and to make sure that the Internet is an open platform for innovation and competition. So that's you know, the basics of net neutrality. Now, what the FCC proposal did basically is a number of things. Number one, no blocking. So an ISP can't block a consumer's access to content on the web, and they can't block a web service's access to the consumer. That's very important. The second thing, no throttling. What's throttling? Well, sometimes ISPs want to slow down a consumer's access to content on the web. This says they can't slow down a web service's access to the consumer. And then no paid prioritization. So an ISP can't charge a web service for faster delivery of their content on their network. So this would involve ISPs holding back content and information from other sources and potentially competing services while letting the person who pays them a fee get faster access and let their data flow more freely. There's going to be no more of that. We think these are very important keys to an open platform on the Internet. And it also puts some other things in there. There's transparency provisions in there so that, you know, Comcast and others have to disclose, you know, how they come about their pricing and that. The rule's really just intended to force ISPs to clearly disclose to consumers what their terms of service are. And all of this, by the way, also applies to mobile broadband. So it's also applying to that. There's privacy protections in there. You know, in Texas, AT&T wanted to roll out a new high-speed Internet service. And what they told their users is, if you're willing to pay $40 a month more, we'll make sure that we don't use your data and sell your data to companies that, you know, to let them know what you're looking at on the Internet so that they can maybe market to you. We want to stop that, too. People's privacy should be their privacy, and ISP shouldn't be allowed to sell where people go on the Internet to other companies for marketing purposes. So that's sort of the top line. You know, that's the big picture of what this does.
And that paints certainly a very thorough picture. We're talking with Congressman Mike Doyle about the net neutrality issues and the recent rules adopted by the FCC. You can join the conversation with a question or comment at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We're going to just about the top of the hour with Congressman Doyle. And so, you know, one of the questions now is what happens next? How will this play out in Congress and the courts potentially?
Well, I think no matter what the FCC did, there could be court action. And so that's not really going to be a surprise. I mean, this will work through the courts. But more importantly, and I think it interesting, is that we're starting to see Republicans now put forward legislative proposals. I think this is very interesting because just a year ago, Republicans said they saw no need for any net neutrality rules. But, you know, this is a process that people sort of get this now. And when the FCC first put out for public comment, 4 million people flooded the FCC's website, actually shut it down for a time. The response was so great. So there is a lot of interest about this, and there's a lot of passion behind it. And now what we're seeing on my committee, on the Energy and Commerce Committee that has jurisdiction for this, is Republicans putting forward legislative proposals for net neutrality. Now, we think the current proposal that they have on the table is rather weak, and they try to take away a lot of the FCC's ability to do rulemaking. But I think it's a step in the right direction. This is the first time we're seeing Republicans showing an interest in moving a legislative proposal. So my hope is that we can work with them on the committee and maybe get some legislative proposals put forward that may negate the need for these lawsuits. So we'll see. I mean, that's further down the road, and we're not there yet, but that's the hope.
Some Republicans in Congress are warning of less innovation as a result of this. I mean, in your view, is there anything about what the FCC is doing that puts the clamps on innovative ideas?
Yeah, you know, I always laugh when I hear that. It's kind of interesting that you'll hear some of these executives say that, you know, this is going to stifle innovation and that they're not going to, have new investment because of this Title II regulation. They say that to us, but what's interesting is when they're talking to the SEC and to their investors, they tell quite a different story. Now, the SEC, they have to tell the truth to the SEC and their investors, and what they say to those folks is that this is not going to affect their investment at all, and it's not going to change their business plans. So you know, we sort of hear, you know, two stories out of companies. On the one hand, they're saying this is going to stifle investment, but when they get in front of the SEC and their investors, they say, no, this isn't going to change our business plans. This isn't going to change our investments at all. And I think that's the reality.
Are there challenges that this could potentially face down the road?
Well, I mean, you know, when this went to Title II, and a lot of us feel that this is going to be stronger legal footing based on the last lawsuit that was filed when Verizon took this to court, it's going to be challenged. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that there's going to be challenges in court. But I think Commissioner Wheeler, when he rewrote this law and this regulation, is that he wanted to make sure that he had a regulation that could withstand the legal framework that the courts were saying, because, you know, in the old case, in the 2010 case, when it was challenged by Verizon, they threw it out because they said that the FCC didn't have the statutory authority to make the type of rules it made under Title I. They do have that authority under Title II. So a lot of us feel that by using Title II, this actually puts the FCC on stronger legal footing than it did when Verizon challenged them in 2010. But, I think maybe Verizon's wishing they hadn't made that initial challenge, because the courts sort of give some instruction to the FCC on how they could put themselves on firmer legal footing. So we'll see what happens.
We're talking with Congressman Mike Doyle about net neutrality issues, developments on that front, and in particular, the net neutrality rules that have been adopted by U.S. regulators as of late last week. What are your thoughts about net neutrality issues? What impacts you as far as this decision going forward? 412-246-2002 is the number to call to join the conversation with Congressman Doyle. 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. PGH. What have you heard from your constituents in the Pittsburgh area about this, Congressman?
It's been largely positive. I think people really get this one. I mean, to be against net neutrality, you'd almost have to just be a stockholder in Verizon or AT&T. I understand the ISPs see this as a new revenue stream. But this is what we want to make sure that consumers and content providers don't have to pay to have their services expedited. That's what this is really all about. And the other thing is, we need competition. Part of the problem here is with internet access is we really don't have a lot of local competition. Now, take Pittsburgh, for instance. If you're lucky, in Pittsburgh, you've got Comcast and Verizon Fios. And really, that actually puts us in a lot better position than a lot of markets around the country where they only have one provider for broadband. I mean, under the FCC's definition of broadband at 25 megabits per second, 75% of the country only has one provider to choose from. And if you go up to double that definition to 50 megabits a second, 82% of the country only has one choice. So, you know, if you don't have competition, and that ISP as the middleman can sort of, you know, regulate who gets access and who doesn't get access, who gets the fast lane and who doesn't get the fast lane based on their ability to pay, that's what stifles innovation. That's what stifles the next big thing happening. You know, these new startup companies don't have a chance competing against big companies that are already well capitalized and can afford to pay. So, you know, that's the thing, and I think people get that idea. When you talk to people in the tech community that really understand this, they think this is very important. You don't get 4 million comments to a rulemaking at the FCC. That's the most comments to a rulemaking ever in the history of the FCC. That didn't happen, you know, for no reason. That happens because people realize how important this is, that we maintain the internet as an open platform, and that's why I think this has a lot of lot of grassroots support behind it. That's why you're seeing Republicans who previously were opposing any net neutrality rules now are offering up legislation, and I think this is moving in a good direction.
412-246-2002, the number to call to join our conversation with Congressman Mike Doyle. We have Steve in Duquesne on the line. Steve, welcome. You're on the air with Congressman Doyle.
Thank you. Congressman Doyle, I appreciate your expertise on such a high degree of technical and legal issues. And my question to you is, I am one of those people who has one choice only if I choose to have actual broadband, the 25 megabits per second service to my home here in Duquesne.
Mm-hmm.
So my question regarding that is, my understanding is there have been hundreds of billions of dollars of tax breaks given to the Internet service providers, both from the federal government and from the states, in return for their commitment to meet broadband wiring to all homes, fiber optic or whatever. And they haven't done that. Can you comment on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. In Pennsylvania, it's been about $20 billion, and they haven't met their commitments. You know, we were expecting widespread deployment of Fios by Verizon, and the initial footprint or the area that they said they were going to cover, they've not met that. I mean, that's part of the problem where you don't have competition. It's a problem. So I live in Forest Hills, and Steve's in Duquesne. In Forest Hills, they deployed some Fios in Forest Hills, so I have a choice of Comcast or Verizon. In Duquesne, Steve doesn't have this choice. And Steve's actually in the majority. The majority of people are in the same position that Steve's in Duquesne, and that's not a good thing. And that's why we have to make sure that we don't let these middlemen, especially in markets where they have a monopoly, where that's his only choice for an ISP, that we can't allow them to start to regulate consumers and content providers and what they get. So I think, you know, that's important. And we've been pressing these companies, you know, that come out and say they're going to do these deployments, trying to hold their feet to the fire. But you're exactly correct that it hasn't happened, and they have received a lot of money.
Let's go to Aaron in Pittsburgh at 412-246-2002. Aaron, you're on the air with Congressman Doyle. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. Just a quick comment. It seems to me that the only innovation that is going to be squashed by the Title II regulation is financial innovation by large companies. It's not. I don't see how it can possibly affect innovation at the small business level. I think my answer's off the air.
Okay. Thank you. Well, if I mean, under this new rule, it won't stifle innovation from a company in a startup place. That's the whole purpose of this rule, is to make sure that we don't stifle that innovation. One of the criticisms have been from the ISPs is that will stifle their investment in the internet. And you know, that's not what they're saying to their investors and to the SEC. It's what they've said to Congress to try to get us to not move in this direction. But I think, you know, the observation is correct that if we keep this an open platform and we don't allow ISPs, we don't allow the middlemen to make this a new revenue stream for the people that can pay, then we won't stifle that innovation. The next big thing can happen. That's all we're trying to do here.
Ultimately, Congressman Doyle, how do you see this impacting rural and low-income communities?
Well, I mean, again, this just you're getting back to the access issue now, and you know, how do we get access to broadband services to areas that, you know, in rural areas and in low income areas? And we've worked with a number of groups in Pittsburgh, for instance, to provide internet access to folks, and we've worked to some degree with Comcast up in poor parts of Pittsburgh where we get reduced fee internet access, as well as, you know, where I think it's about, I want to say $10 a month, people can get access to the internet. So there are, you know, some of the ISPs, it's mobile and Wi-Fi, and there's places up people can go to get Wi-Fi access with their computers. So some of the ISPs, and Comcast is one of them, by the way, they're doing some good things in Pittsburgh. In terms of trying to address people's access in the poor communities where they operate. So I give them, you know, I'm tough on them sometimes, but I got to give them credit where credit's due. In the city of Pittsburgh, they've been good partners with us to help with the access problem for the poor. Now, it's in the rural sections, it's you know, a little bit tougher that mobile broadband is you know, also going to be a big way that people are going to be able to access the internet. You know, 318 million people in the United States have a smartphone, and a lot of them, you know, are going to be able to access the internet that way.
Before we go, Congressman, I wanted to switch gears a little bit about a pressing issue. Are we facing another homeland security, potential homeland security shutdown later this week? Republicans are demanding that any long-term funding bill contain language that would repeal President Obama's immigration initiatives. Where do things stand with that?
Well, I've got some good news for you on that, Paul. Actually, yesterday, we passed in the House. The Republicans finally came to their senses, and Speaker Boehner put on the floor a full funding bill for the Homeland Security Department that was clean without any of the immigration riders on it, and a combination of Democrats and Republicans passed that bill out of the House, and the crisis has been averted. Boehner basically marginalized the more extreme wing of his caucus and decided to put a clean bill on the floor and let the House work its will, and that's what we did. And so now the department is fully funded through the end of the fiscal year, and that crisis has been averted.
Well, that's good news, and I'm sure there are a lot of people after the tense moments from last Friday, you know, wondering what was going to happen later this week, that are happy to hear that, and we appreciate that update from you, Congressman Doyle, and all of your insight about net neutrality. Again, Congressman Mike Doyle joining us by phone from Washington. Thanks again for your time, sir. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul. Have a great day.
You too. And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you have a comment or a question about today's show, you can send it to us at ESSPGH at WESA.FM. You can also go to our website at WESA.FM to revisit past segments or entire shows from our archive. Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, a conversation with actor Stan Houston, one of the stars of the movie Selma. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.